I'm from Bethlehem City. I'm a mother of four, and I'm the program director of Women of the Sun. We are working on empowering Palestinian women economically and politically with saving the environment.
I live in the center of Israel. I'm married and with two kids. And I have been active in Women Wage Peace for 7 years and urging the leaders to begin negotiations with the active participation of women in the process.
I speak to Zanti Scharf, a gender expert, writer, and co-founder of the Fuller Project, a global non-profit newsroom dedicated to reporting on women. In an article on foreign policy, Zanti speaks to two women's organizations, one Israeli, Women Wage Peace, and one Palestinian, Women of the Sun, who lobby together for the resumption of peace negotiations. I am Arno Siad, and this is Prios Peace in a Pod. Zanti, welcome to the episode.
Thank you, Arno. So glad to be here with you.
Can you tell us about these two organizations, who they are, and what are they trying to do?
Women of the Sun is a Palestinian women-led NGO that was launched in 2022. And what they want is a return to negotiations, like you said, and a permanent resolution to the conflict between Israel and Palestine. Women Wage Peace was founded before, actually in the wake of an operation called Protective Edge in 2014, which was an Israeli invasion into Gaza. And it came after Secretary Kerry had been working to try to restart final status negotiations. That effort had failed. They have the same mission as Women of the Sun, although they both know their audiences and speak to their audiences on the issues that are important. And they work together to advocate for women to have a seat at the table. And they also train women so that they're ready to participate in talks.
Right. And it's fair to say that the situation has gone from bad to worse in the region in the recent weeks and months. Are you in touch with them still? What are they telling you about the current situation in Gaza?
We are in pretty constant touch through reporting their stories for Foreign Policy some months back. I got to know their work quite well and have continued to follow them and continue to report on their work. The situation is devastating. And in the words of a woman who I'm going to refer to as MH to protect her privacy, who is one of the co-founders of Women of the Sun, they are screaming, stop the bloodshed. Stop the bloodshed. And in the words of Dr. Yael Braudo-Bahat, who is one of the co-founders of Women Wage Peace, what she says is the children in the region are dying instead of living. And what they want, full stop, is stop the killing.
The co-founder of the Israeli organization, Women Wage Peace, Vivian Silver, was murdered by Hamas on October 7th. What impact did that have on the organization? Did it affect the work they do in partnership with their Palestinian counterpart?
This was a devastating loss to Women Wage Peace, most definitely. Vivian Silver was one of Israel's best-known campaigners. And for Yael, in talking with her, our conversation stopped for a long pause because she said that the organization was in mourning when they found her remains. They were actually close friends. Silver was a mentor to Yael. And in fact, Yael was messaging with her when she heard Hamas coming into her home and she fled to her safe house. And Yael was sending her messages of support. So the impact on those individuals and the impact on the organization is probably far beyond what I can imagine just from hearing the story. That being said, everything that these organizations do is turn pain into power for peace. Both Yael and also MH, they say, out of the ashes comes the work. In Yael's word, from the horror of this and from the ashes, peace is her mission. And in MH's words as well, people are dying in Gaza. She has lost over 32 members of Women of the Sun in Gaza with their families. And she says this just gives us more reason that we have to be more resilient and continue our shared fight for peace. These organizations, these women talk daily. They have not missed a day because of October 7th or on the day that Vivian Silver's remains were found. They continue to talk. They're devoted to talking and to continuing their work together.
Yes, and we can only imagine the pain they're going through as they try to continue their work in that organization after having lost their co-founder. And I'm guessing this goes for Women of the Sun as well. In your article, you mentioned it can be, in fact, dangerous to be part of that organization, that there is a stigma around partnering with an Israeli organization. So how do Palestinian women work through the shame associated with working with what many will perceive as the enemy?
This is painful. And in fact, I think we can relate and understand this from other people's stories as well. In the U.S., on college campuses, people aren't talking. And yet these women continue to talk to one another. And it's not easy. It is not easy. It's frustrating. They're trying to hold the middle in a situation where very many people want to pull apart. And what MH told me is that there is a criticism of those who really fight for peace because it implies some kind of normalization. Or in the case of Palestine, to some people could imply that the status quo, as far as who is in charge of what land or what policies are in place, that the status quo is acceptable. And what MH has done, I think, is free herself from those criticisms and root herself in what she believes, which is that we need a peaceful future. I think the other piece going along with that really values-based view of the world is that they root themselves in motherhood and they root themselves in partnership and community. MH and Yael are both mothers, and they have talked about how they need to help heal a wounded region. And together they formed the Mother's Call, which they worked on for 9 months leading up to October 4th of 2023, where they marched together, the two organizations, to the Dead Sea to bring this shared campaign together and sit together, women from Palestine and Israel, at a table and show that people can come together for peace. And as MH has said, she has hundreds of women colleagues in Gaza and about 2,500 women in the West Bank as well. So together in their beliefs, they're strong.
That was just 3 days before the attacks of October 7th by Hamas. And I mean, it's a simple question, but many of our listeners will be wondering, what have these two women's organizations achieved so far together? Have they had any real impact?
They have had impact in what is a very difficult situation that many people think is intractable. And what they've been able to do is pretty amazing. To be able to gather women together, to be able to work on the process of getting Palestinian women or working with Palestinian women to get the paperwork, to get out, to be able to be together, to have trainings, to have these enormous marches, which garner a lot of press attention, to be able to invite dignitaries, international, and also from the region. So there's a public opinion impact, which is tangible. They're reaching a huge number of people and converting those people into peace activists who can actually do work together. They've also trained a large number of women so that they are ready to partake in peace negotiations. And as far as the peace negotiations themselves, at the time of reporting, neither MH nor Yael knew of any woman who had been invited into track one official negotiations. But they and a broader community of women peace builders and organizations together, their work has resulted in at least one woman being invited into track two and track three negotiations. I think the number is higher than that, but people are not talking about that for security reasons. So there is an awareness that women need to be involved. There is a fight to get them to the table that is very difficult. And I would expect that as conversations continue and when they mature and move forward and there's more discussion about recovery, I would expect that those trained women are going to be called upon in more ways, and they'll be ready to do that.
In your article, you mention how these women were inspired by other movements, particularly from Northern Ireland and Liberia. How do these Palestinian and Israeli women translate the lessons from other movements to the context of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
Arno, the interesting thing is that this is actually one global movement, which is for women at the table during times of negotiation, because when women are at the table, those negotiations turn out better. In cases where women are at the table, a peace agreement is 35% more likely to last 15 years or more. So the interesting thing is, in a situation that appears to some to be intractable, everything should be leveraged for peace, especially if there's hard evidence behind it. And so women have been working on this issue of getting women to the table during negotiations and also acknowledging that women are disproportionately affected by war for decades. And the Northern Ireland Agreement was really important in propelling that conversation forward. So YEL and MH know about these movements. They also know the women who are advancing the global agenda that has learned from Northern Ireland and Liberia and is also supporting women worldwide. Northern Ireland, ahead of the formal talks that did lead to the Belfast Agreement, Catholic and Protestant women's groups were organized and formed the Northern Ireland Women's Coalition. They were successful in gaining two seats at a table of 20 in formal negotiations. And they were one of the few groups to move beyond the sectarian divide and to work together on issues. And because of that, they gained trust, and that allowed them to be effective. And they also are credited with ensuring that the agreement would provide more fulsomely for recovery and social inclusion efforts as well. Their work actually inspired and helped to propel the work that was already underway to pass the UN Resolution 1325, which is a global resolution to recognize how women are impacted during war and also to take actions, for countries to take actions to promote women's leadership in these circumstances as well.
Zanthi, thank you so much.
Thank you, Arno.
I now speak to Professor Azza Karam, the former Secretary General of Religions for Peace, an organization that facilitates global collaboration among religious communities to promote peace and resolve conflicts. She's here in Oslo as part of the UN High-Level Seminar on Gender and Inclusive Mediation Processes, an initiative for envoys and mediators, with a focus on strategies to increase women's participation in peace mediation. And we are joined by Torun Trigestad, PRIO's Deputy Director and the Director of the PRIO Center on Gender, Peace and Security. Azza, Torun, welcome to this episode.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Azza, we just heard from Zanthi and her reporting on these two Israeli and Palestinian women organizations. So I'm going to start with a simple question. Why is it important that particular attention be drawn to the place of women in peace mediation processes? Why does it matter?
Because they're just as important a part of the group, population, community that is affected, impacted, and active in a situation of conflict. It can't just be one group that gets to leverage the war and make the peace. Everyone is impacted, therefore women have to be part of that situation of resolution, just as they are part of the situation of confrontation.
Torun, Zanthi said something quite striking, that in cases where women are at the table, a peace agreement is 35% more likely to last 15 years or more. What does academic research tell us about outcomes when women are involved in peace mediations?
Well, actually, stone study is just one of several studies that have been published in recent years pointing in the same direction. They show a little bit of variation in the exact numbers, but they are all reaching somewhat similar conclusion. That when women are involved in peace mediation processes, these processes are actually more likely to reach an agreement, and that agreements will typically also then include more provisions on women's rights and gender equality, and that agreements will last longer. So there was one study by Jana Kraus and colleagues back in 2018 that concluded that women's participation seems to positively impact both the quality and the durability of peace. And this is something that civil society organizations and particularly women's groups have been arguing for decades, and they have produced numerous reports and case studies, but it's typically then been referred to as anecdotal evidence. So it's just in recent years that academia has started to pick up on this and study peace processes from a gender perspective. And with these sorts of conclusions, we also now see that policymakers are paying more interest to these academic studies.
Right. Aza, can you share an example where women's involvement has been pivotal in a peace process?
Well, I think there's actually quite a few. One of the most renowned, shall we say, from the northern context is Northern Ireland, where it wasn't just about, quote unquote, having women at the table, but it was also about a canvassing of women's rights and human rights organizations and the voices of the human rights community that women actors and activists did very, very well, and women politicians did well. And it's one of the most labor-intensive, if you will, peace processes that was taken in the Northern Hemisphere. And as we can see, there's been many hiccups, but it has maintained, it has lasted, it is sustainable. Another very good example from the Global South, I would say, is Liberia, although there are many others. But I think that you can see there where women have to push, insist, demand their own representation and participation, that we see a lasting context and sustainable, quote unquote, peace. I think one of the points we do need to bring out very clearly, however, it's not just the participation or representation at the negotiation or mediation tables and spaces of any women. It is most particularly the engagement, the participation of those women who also have a very clear gender equality experience, interest, and standards in their mind that they can bring to those negotiating and mediation spaces. Any woman is great, but women who have the experience of fighting and realizing gender equality and women's rights specific issues are a definite requirement as well as advantage.
And Northern Ireland and Liberia, the two examples that Zanti mentioned as well in her article. I am just wondering about the variables in this. For instance, women in leadership roles or the inclusion of gender specific issues during a mediation. Torun, according to academic research, what factors have been found to contribute to successful mediations when women are involved?
Well, maybe I should first start with emphasizing that in terms of leadership, to date, there are still very few women who have been leading peace mediation or has served as chief peace mediators. So when these academic studies talk about women's participation in peace mediation, it's typically women as members of peace mediation teams. But what they point to then is that when women are involved, they are typically concerned about designing processes that are inclusive, as also Asa referred to in the beginning here. They are concerned about not only including women, but all marginalized groups in society. And thereby, I think that if you manage to create inclusive processes, you also create a stronger sense of ownership to the peace process and the peace agreement in society at large. So that's one thing. And closely associated with this sort of societal ownership is also the fact that women involved in peace mediation often are much more actively engaged in consultations with civil society, and particularly with women's groups. So women mediators often go back and forth from the formal table to, you know, parallel tracks and consult with women's groups and then bring issues back to the formal table. So they often operate with a strong constituency of supporters behind them. And finally, I think that quite a few studies have found that when women are participating, they are much better at focusing on reconciliation and bringing, you know, groups together across political, ethnic and religious divides, which I find quite interesting and also important for building peace. So I think these are some of the key elements that women bring to peace processes.
And I'm guessing that it is, of course, more difficult for women to exist in the political sphere in certain places around the world. Aza, until recently, you served as the Secretary General of Religions for Peace, the largest multi-religious leadership platform in the world. And you are also a professor of religion and development in Amsterdam. Based on your research and what you've experienced and witnessed in your career, how do religious and cultural beliefs impact the effectiveness of women as peace mediators, especially in more conservative societies?
Well, I think, to be very honest, culture in general, of which religion is part, cultures always impact on the way people think, believe, and behave. That's just a given fact, and there's enough studies over aeons that show this. So anything that is impacting on people's behaviors and belief systems and their attitude will obviously play a very important role. We tend to think that in more conservative cultures, there will be more restraints on women's full and equal participation in public spaces. And that is absolutely proven. I think the issue here is that we see the extent to which, and I believe Torun brought out that very important distinction between participation and leadership. And it isn't as if women are never participating in peace mediations and negotiations and processes. Of course, they have to be. They're part of the community. But the question is the extent to which they have a role to lead some of these spaces and engagements. And I think, again, we just quietly remember that there was Mo Molum in the Northern Ireland context, who was a leader of the negotiating process for the Northern Ireland peace process.
Both sides are now asking the other, are you really serious? And unfortunately, both sides seem all too willing to contemplate the possibility of failure. But I ask people to remember just how far we have come. How much difference the ceasefires are making to life in Northern Ireland.
And I think that makes a difference, indeed. But I also think we have to understand that Northern Ireland and the UK in general are not always seen as libertarian and egalitarian. There's always advances and missteps. But the more challenging it is for women to play a role as equals in a public context, the more challenging it will be for them to be allowed or given the space or even looked at when they are participating, let alone leading. And I think we can say with very honest sort of appraisal of a number of different situations that where there are very conservative mores and tendencies, you often do not see women in the leading spaces of mediation processes, but you still do see them participating at various levels because it's not just one table. Again, as Toru nuanced, there are multiple tables that need to be sorted, engaged, conversed with, voices brought thereto and thereof. So women are playing plentiful roles. Again, the point is the extent to which those with conservative understandings of women's limitation and limited leadership, public leadership, that's where we want to see and where we see a challenge for a lot of women to be openly leading processes.
And how to ensure more women are in these leadership roles, as you both say, is the reason why the UN High-Level Seminar on Gender and Inclusive Mediation Processes is taking place here in Oslo this week. So, Torun, can you talk to us about that seminar?
Yeah, sure. Well, this was a seminar that was initiated actually back in 2013 by the UN, the UN Department of Peacebuilding and Political Affairs. And, well, as you said, because they recognize that it is a leadership responsibility to try and include more women in peace processes and also apply a gender perspective on process work. So it was initiated back then. They reached out to us here at PRIO and to the CMI, the Martti Ahtisaari Peace Foundation in Finland, and asked if we would like to collaborate on this. And we found that quite interesting. And the target group of this seminar is exactly the leading mediators, peace mediators, meaning UN envoys, special representatives and their senior advisors, but also representatives of regional organizations and member states that are particularly active in peace mediation, such as Norway. But throughout the years, we have also included in this group representatives from civil society organizations, because we think it's really, really important to have this sort of exchange between different actor groups that are involved in peace mediation efforts. So over the years, we have brought these people together over 2 to 3 days to share experiences, challenges, and we are trying to equip them with tools and strategies for what they can do to increase the number of women in peace processes, and what they can do when they are negotiating language of, let's say, ceasefire agreements. So to date, we have trained or, you know, invited more than 290 participants to these seminars. And as of this year, then we will be able to add another 23. And we are extremely happy to have Asa joining us this year to talk about the challenges of culture and religion, because that's something that these mediators are bringing up all the time, that they find it really challenging to, you know, grapple with when they are meeting groups like Taliban, who are arguing strongly against a role for women. So how do they handle such situations? So I'm sure that this is something that will be debated during the next couple of days.
Right. And as you mentioned, of course, Asa, you are in Norway as the keynote speaker to that UN high-level seminar. So as we wrap this episode, I wonder, Asa, how you envision the future of women in peace mediation, particularly in leadership roles, and what steps must be taken to realize that vision?
I think it's, quite frankly, an inevitability to see more and more women in leadership seats in mediation. It's an inevitable progression. But I do believe that, like all things related to women and gender, it is those who are populating and making the decisions who often try to hide behind some of the cultural excuses. But in fact, these are exactly where we have to demand that the conditionality of women's representation and leadership. And I believe there's enough international legal backing, including Security Council Resolution 1325, amongst others, that mandates that those at the table respect and ensure this. Women's voices, as you can see from what Santi was writing, women's own groups and organizations are ready, willing, able, and demanding.
Asa, Turun, thank you both.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
This episode was produced by Arno Sead and edited by Brage Pedersen. Find out more about PRIO's research, op-eds, seminars, and events on PRIO.org.